Picture this. It's March 5th, 1936. A cold gray morning at Eastleigh Aerodrome, just outside Southampton, England. A low-wing monoplane sits on the grass, its nose pointed into a wind that smells like channel fog and aviation fuel. The airplane is unlike anything the crowd of engineers and factory workers has seen before. The wings are elliptical, not straight, not tapered, elliptical, curved along the leading edge and the trailing edge, both like nothing anyone had thought practical to build before. The man who drew those wings is standing off to the side watching. He is 39 years old, he knows he is dying, and he wants to see his airplane fly before that happens. I'm Taildragger, and this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Today we're talking about the Supermarine Spitfire. Now, Reginald Joseph Mitchell didn't set out to build a fighter, he set out to build the fastest airplane in the world. That's what the Schneider Trophy demanded. The trophy was an international seaplane air race, started in 1913 by a French industrialist named Jacques Schneider, and by the late 1920s it was the most prestigious aviation competition on the planet. Countries poured national pride and government money into it. Supermarine, the little Southampton flying boat company where Mitchell was chief designer, entered three times, and three times Mitchell's seaplanes won. The third win came in 1931 when Mitchell's S.6B seaplane posted a speed of 340 miles per hour, the world airspeed record held by a British aircraft for the first time. That machine had a Rolls-Royce R engine hanging off its nose and floats underneath, but the aerodynamic thinking behind it was pure Mitchell. Thin airfoils, precision engineering, minimum drag, maximum speed. The Air Ministry had been watching. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. In 1931, the Royal Air Force was still flying biplanes. Fabric-covered, wire-braced, open-cockpit biplanes. The ministry issued a specification for a new monoplane fighter, and they asked Mitchell to see what he could build. The first attempt, the Type 224, was so ungainly that Mitchell himself reportedly told the test pilot to just land it and be done with it. He went back to the drawing board without a word of complaint. That was the kind of man he was. What he came back with was the airplane standing on the grass at Eastleigh that March morning. The elliptical wing was a stroke of genius that came at a price. It was fiendishly difficult to manufacture. Every single wing rib had a different profile. You couldn't stamp them out in batches. Each one had to be built almost by hand, fitted and fared by craftsmen who spent entire careers mastering that single compound curve. Later in the war, when production needed to ramp up fast, that ellipse would become a headache for every factory supervisor in Britain. There are accounts of workers at Castle Bromwich, where the bulk of the Spitfires were built, spending weeks learning to skin those wings without distortion. The American factories that eventually visited to study British production methods looked at those wing jigs and shook their heads, but it was the right shape for what the airplane needed to do. The ellipse gave the Spitfire a thin wing, lower induced drag, and a more gradual stall than a straight tapered design. It meant the airplane could fly faster and turn tighter without the wing giving up on you. And buried inside that wing, later, would be the ammunition bays and gun bays that the airplane depended on. The shape was not decorative, every curve earned its place. The engine was the other half of the equation. Rolls-Royce was developing something called the PV-12, an inline liquid-cooled V-12 that would eventually carry the name Merlin. The name was chosen from a list of birds of prey that Rolls-Royce used for their aero engines. The combination of Mitchell's airframe and the Merlin engine was, to use a word that gets overused in aviation history but genuinely applies here, electric. The man who flew the Spitfire on that first March morning was Captain Joseph Mutz Summers, Vickers chief test pilot. Summers was known for being careful and methodical. He put the airplane through its paces, came back around, and put it down on the grass at Eastleigh. Then he climbed out and reportedly told the assembled team, "Don't touch anything." Some accounts say, "Don't change a thing." The exact words have been debated ever since, but the meaning was clear enough. The airplane was right. Mitchell was there. He watched it fly. He didn't say much. He never said much. Now here's where it gets interesting. Reginald Mitchell had been diagnosed with rectal cancer in 1933. He had surgery, and for a while it looked like he might beat it. He went right back to work. He traveled to Germany in 1936 to watch the Luftwaffe's latest fighters at an air display, came home deeply alarmed at what he had seen, and pushed the development of his fighter even harder. He knew what was coming. He understood it with a clarity that the British government, at that moment still hoping for peace, had not yet reached. He died on June 11, 1937. He was 42 years old. The Battle of Britain was 3 years away. The development of the Spitfire passed to Joseph Smith, a quiet and methodical engineer who had worked alongside Mitchell for years. Smith is one of the unsung figures in aviation history. He inherited an already extraordinary airplane and spent the next decade making it better without losing what made it great. That is harder than starting from scratch. Smith guided the Spitfire through 24 major marks before production ended in 1948. He is the reason the airplane that fought in 1945 bore any family resemblance at all to the one that first flew in 1936.
The early Spitfire had 8303 Browning machine guns buried in those elliptical wings. Later marks went to heavier cannon armament. The Merlin engine gave way to the Rolls-Royce Griffin in the Mark 12 and beyond, nearly doubling the power output over the course of the war. The Mark 1 that fought in the Battle of Britain did around 360 miles per hour. The final marks were touching 450. The airframe just kept absorbing more engine, more armament, more roll. Photo reconnaissance Spitfires flew stripped of guns and armor, painted in a faint pastel blue, climbing to altitudes where the cockpit iced over and the pilot's breath fogged the gun sight. Seafires, the carrier variants, flew from fleet decks with clipped wingtips and folding mechanisms that Mitchell never designed for. The airplane accommodated all of it. 20,351 Spitfires were built before production ended. In the Battle of Britain, through that long summer and fall of 1940, Spitfires were outnumbered and outworked. The Hurricane carried more of the numerical load, as we've covered on this show before, but the Spitfire was tasked with going after the German fighter escort. The Messerschmitt 109 was its opposite number, and pilots on both sides came to understand their opponent with a kind of grudging professional respect. The Spitfire turned better. The 109 had fuel injection that allowed negative G maneuvers without the engine cutting out, something the early Spitfires couldn't match. A Spitfire pilot who pushed forward on the stick to dive away would watch his Merlin cough and sputter in those first seconds. German pilots learned to exploit that gap. Among the men who figured out how to compensate and still survive was a South African pilot named Adolf Malan, known to everyone as Sailor. Malan flew Spitfires with 74 Squadron and became one of the most effective fighter pilots the Royal Air Force produced, scoring 27 confirmed kills. But more than his personal score, Malan wrote what became known as his 10 Rules of Air Fighting, a tactical document so clear and practical that it was distributed across RAF Fighter Command. Rules like wait until you see the whites of his eyes and go in quickly, punch hard, get out. Malan understood that a dogfight was not an aerobatic display. It was work, ugly, fast, violent work, and his airplane gave him the tools to do that work at the highest level. The pilots who flew Spitfires have been talking about them ever since. Veterans have described the cockpit smell, oil and rubber and something like hot metal that no writer has ever quite captured. They've described the way the airplane responded, almost telepathic, like it knew what you wanted before you moved the stick. They've described the sound of the Merlin at full throttle, a sound that stands alone in the world of piston engines and that, if you've ever heard it at an air show, you do not forget. Which brings us to today, and why this matters to anyone standing in a hangar right now. There are still flying Spitfires. The Battle of Britain Memorial Flight at Royal Air Force Coningsby in Lincolnshire operates 6 of them, along with Lancasters and Hurricanes, flying display seasons all over Britain. The aircraft restoration company at Duxford has put multiple airframes back in the air over the past decade. Private collectors in the United States, in Europe, in Australia have found wrecks, sometimes literally excavated from the fields where they force-landed 60 or 70 years ago and rebuilt them to airworthy condition. Every recovery is a small miracle of patience and money and skill. Some of those restorations have taken longer than the entire span of the war. There is something about a Spitfire that draws people who have never been in a cockpit as readily as it draws people who have logged 10,000 hours. Part of it is the shape. That elliptical wing is one of the most beautiful things that has ever been attached to an airplane, and everyone seems to know it even if they can't say why. Part of it is the story. The dying man and the drawing board and the airplane that outlived him to do exactly what he built it for. Pull up a chair at a Warbird gathering sometime and find an old restoration mechanic who has spent months working on one. Buy him a cup of coffee. He will tell you things about that elliptical wing spar and those hand-fitted ribs that will take the better part of an afternoon, and you will leave a better pilot for it. That's the Spitfire. Mitchell's airplane, the one that Mutt Summers flew once and said don't touch a thing, and he was right. Sources today include Jonathan Glancy's book Spitfire, the biography along with the Royal Air Force Museum in Hendon, and the Imperial War Museum at Duxford. More aviation history at radiohangar.com. I'm Taildragger. Keep the shiny side up.